for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. European ministers yesterday agreed on a plan to ease 6 days of severe flight restrictions. Flights had begun taking off in some areas, but a new ash cloud from the erupting volcano in Iceland threatens to keep many airplanes grounded. Joining me in the studio to discuss the economic consequences, Anthony Smallwood. He's spokesperson for the European Union delegation here in Washington. And Steve Lott. He's head of communications for the International Air Transport Association in North America. And with us by phone from London is the U.S. business editor of The Economist, New York bureau chief, Matthew Bishop. We'll hope to have him on the line with us quite soon. But first, let's go to NPR science reporter Joe Palca. He's on the line with us from Reykjavik, Iceland. Good morning to you, Joe.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to hear your voice. What's the latest on the status of the volcano itself?
Well, the last report that was released, which was a couple of hours ago, said that the volcano has quieted down. It started quieting down on Sunday morning, and it's still putting out some ash, but not nearly as much as it did in the first couple days of the eruption. The big story, I guess, for today or for the coming days is going to be where that ash goes. And that's a meteorological question. It depends on which way the winds are blowing. Right now, they've been blowing pretty hard to the south, blowing toward Europe. And that's both at the ground and up in the stratosphere, higher up. Today, they at least on the ground, they seem to have calmed down quite a bit.
Tell me why it is that scientists are having such difficulty figuring out how this volcano is going to continue reacting.
Well, I think it speaks to the uncertainty of the science. These are complicated structures deep in the earth that are subjected to movement and pressure that we can only infer from ground-based recordings. And so basically you're having to make an educated guess every time you see something on a seismograph or see the earth move or see some gas come off the volcano to think, okay, so what does that mean? What does this magma, this hot material from deep in the earth below the crust, where is that coming from? What's it going to do, and how's it going to behave when it hits the surface? And I think that's why this is such an exciting event, if I can say that, for a volcanologist, because they're learning a lot each time. You can't make these things go off. So when they go off on their own, you want to go and study them and learn as much as you can.
And why has this one been so explosive?
Well, the truth is, Diane, this one hasn't been that explosive. It's just gotten a lot of attention because of where the ash plume went. In general, when you have a sheet of ice sitting on top of the top of a volcano and the hot magma hits the ice, there's going to be explosions because the ice expands extremely rapidly.
I see.
And you can actually get the ice to explode. So in that sense, it's exploding because of the ice on top. But in another sense, it's a kind of a small volcano, and I can promise you that had the winds been blowing a different direction, you would not be doing a show about this today, or you might, I suppose, but it wouldn't have gotten a lot of attention from most of the world's press.
So what's the likelihood we might see other eruptions from other volcanoes as a reaction to this one?
Well, specifically as a reaction to this one, I think it's hard to say, but the likelihood that we'll see others from Iceland is inevitable. I mean, this place is largely built from volcanoes. There are several of them on the island, and there are several of them that have gone off in the last few decades and will probably go off in the next few decades. Again, the question is, which way are they going to go off in?
Now, I understand you have a plane to catch.
So I do.
So you're going to have to leave us at 10:15, but how are you flying and where?
I'm flying on Iceland Air, and Reykjavik Airport has been open through the entire event here.
How come?
Well, if you just have to get out a map and look to see where Keflavik, I guess that's the name of the town where the airport is, where Keflavik is in relationship to Eyjafjallajökull. There, I said it. It's pretty much it's close to 100 miles, maybe a little less, to the west of the volcano. The volcano is east of here.
I see.
And the winds are just blowing south, and so there's nothing here in Reykjavik that would give you any hint that there was a volcano going on in Iceland, except for the large numbers of media and the constant pictures on the television.
So people are carrying on business as usual.
Totally.
Okay. One last question for you. We received an email from Joe Sutter. He's CEO of a nonprofit called Wild Birds for the 21st Century. He says, if jet planes cannot fly through this silicate curtain, can Northern European wild birds or other natural environment live? This could be worse than Valdez. Birds and bees are keystone species, essential insectivores and pollinators for food supplies. Are they safe? Joe?
I'm sorry, I heard that, but I didn't hear your question. Can you repeat it?
So, are these birds and insects safe?
It's hard to say. I think that the birds and insects have a few more choices about where they want to fly than the jetliners. And as I said, you can fly out of this plume fairly easily if you happen to go in the right direction. And a lot of it's over the ocean. What it's doing to life in Europe, I really couldn't speak to. But we did see birds in the plume and horses, for that matter, because they had a horse ranch that was in the plume when I was there, which was right near the volcano. And nobody, we humans certainly didn't like it, so I'm sure it was most unpleasant for the birds and horses.
Joe Palka, he's NPR science reporter. He's been on the line with us from Reykjavik, Iceland. Joe, good luck when you get on that plane, and stay safe.
I'll do my best, Diane. Thank you very much.
And thanks for joining us. And now to you, Steve Lott. How much has the disruption in flights cost the airline industry?
There's no question, Diane, that this has been catastrophic to the airline industry. In fact, it's now on a scale that's larger than we saw after 9/11. After 9/11, we saw the U.S. airspace close for about 3 days. Currently, we've seen European airspace, we're on day 6 of this crisis. We're talking upwards of 60, 70,000 flights, millions of passengers affected. And really, this can't come at a worse time for the airline industry.
Why?
Which has lost billions of dollars in recent years. Just last year alone, the airlines lost about $9.5 billion. Mm. So our current estimate is that through this crisis, the airlines have been losing about $200 million in revenue per day. And frankly, I think that's on the conservative side. So we're now on day 5 or 6. We're looking at revenue losses of about $1 billion. So this is a tremendous hit on the industry.
And joining us now by phone is Matthew Bishop. He's U.S. business editor and New York bureau chief of The Economist. Good morning to you, Matthew. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Please tell me how the disruption has affected you personally.
Well, I'm currently on a book tour for my new book, The Road from Ruin, and I flew to London on Thursday from Chicago, got in on the last plane in, basically, to Heathrow, and I'm now stuck here. No idea when I'm going to get back to New York, where I live. I'm supposed to be speaking this evening at the Kansas City Library, and I'm going to be doing that by video link at about 12:30 in the morning, London time. Tonight, and I'm still wondering when I'm ever going to get back to America. And I've been spending a lot of time you know, with the other refugees that are stranded over here. Initially, everybody thought this was tremendous fun, an extra kind of surprise weekend to hang out in London where the weather's been unusually warm and beautiful. But now everyone's getting very frustrated because we simply don't know when we're going to be able to get out. And obviously people are missing loved ones, particularly parents with young children are missing their children.
Now, am I correct in saying that some flights are taking off from Heathrow starting today?
Well, I think they've just announced that all the flights leaving that were due to leave Heathrow today, which would have been the first flights out since Thursday, have actually now been cancelled because there was another eruption from the volcano, which you can't pronounce. that sent a fresh cloud over Britain. So parts of Northern Europe, France, I think, has had flights out. And obviously Madrid has been going fairly strongly. Mm. But London, all the main London airports are continuing to be closed. And I think the dilemma all of us face here is that we know we could get on a, we could try and get across to Spain or try and go to Reykjavik, where your correspondent was talking from. But that takes quite a long time, and there's no guarantee you'd be able to get on a plane quickly when you got there. Meanwhile, at any moment, London might open up again, and so you'd be sitting there in Madrid or Iceland feeling deeply frustrated that you'd left London. So most people are sort of hanging on here and hoping for the best, but it's a little worrying, particularly when there's this other volcano next door to the one that you can't pronounce that people say usually goes off a few days after.
Matthew Bishop is U.S. business editor and New York bureau chief for The Economist. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, we'll talk further. Take your phone calls, 800-433-8850. Talking about the disruptions created by the eruption of the volcano in Iceland that has stalled traffic across Europe, especially airline traffic. Airplanes were supposed to have gotten out of Heathrow today, but that now has been canceled. Here in the studio, Steve Lott, he's head of communications for IATA, and that is the International Air Transport Association in North America, and Anthony Smallwood, he's spokesperson for the European Union delegation here in Washington, D.C. Joining us by phone is Matthew Bishop. He's U.S. business editor, New York bureau chief for The Economist. However, because of the eruption of the volcano, he's stuck in London and will be there. We don't know how long. Anthony Smallwood, tell us about the European Union's 27 transport ministers' video conference yesterday and what they decided.
Well, of course, Diane, they had to have a video conference because they couldn't fly as they planned to do for a conference in person. But they broadly approved the measures taken to, in a sense, diversify the reaction in terms of the no-fly zone area over much of Western Europe. to have a no-fly, a small no-fly zone. And as you've heard from Matthew, much of England is covered by that today. A fly with caution zone, if you like, and a free fly zone. So that was a series of measures which was broadly approved. But also subsequent to the meeting, the Commission has come out with very strong recommendations to member states on flexibility with respect to visitors who are there on short-term visas or visitors transiting Europe on no visa at all, trying to get out. So that a whole series of measures has been taken to try and make life easier for the thousands and thousands of people who are quite literally stranded, not just in airports, but often, by the way, in other, in sort of railway stations and other places, trying to get out by other methods.
And Steve Lott, what about the Air Transport Association's reactions to what the ministers have decided for now?
Absolutely. Well, we do welcome what the ministers decided yesterday. Our concern and our criticism yesterday was, why did it take 5 days to get there? This was a crisis that enveloped Europe, that affected international flights around the world. So why did it take 5 days to get all the ministers on a call, on a video conference to discuss this issue? We also were concerned about the decisions or the leadership or the lack of coordination in opening or closing this airspace. To date, it's been a bit of a patchwork, which makes it frustrating for both passengers and airlines. And we hope going through the down the road that we will see more leadership, more coordination, and make decisions on opening and closing airspace based on actual risk, do a risk assessment. Clearly, if the ash is too heavy, we're not going to fly. The airlines don't want to put passengers and their aircraft in harm's way. But we think that rather it's not black or white. There's a gray area there where perhaps we can evaluate, as the ministers discussed yesterday, certain corridors that will allow flights.
Anthony, first of all, to Steve's question, why did it take 5 days for the ministers to have a video call?
It took 5 days for the ministers to have a video call, but it didn't take 5 days to have reactions to what was happening. And I think it's a rather unfair criticism, frankly. Initially, the approach was indeed very cautious, but don't forget, it's only just over a week ago that we were mourning the tragic loss of much of the Polish leadership in an airplane accident. People, quite rightly, were overwhelmingly sensitive to the risk. And it's not a risk that's, frankly, that easy to categorize. These clouds don't move around according to absolutely predetermined schedules. It's very difficult to define precisely where the risk is and what it is. And most of the instrumentation, by the way, in airliners cannot detect it. It needs very specialist equipment. So it's very difficult to know precisely where the risk is overwhelmingly dangerous, and of course you should stop there. But until you know that there is no risk, you really can't take the risk of letting planes fly.
Matthew Bishop, we, of course, have been focusing much of the attention on the airline industry, but I would assume there are a great many other industries that have been hard hit by this crisis.
Well, I think one of the ironies of a crisis like this is that although certain industries get really badly hit, like the airline industry, the overall effect on the economy is unlikely to be all that large because, you know, for example, a lot of the other forms of transport, the trains and bus transport, is actually busier now and making more money. Eurostar put its prices up to get people across the English Channel, for example. So that nets out the effect that the airline's being hit. And then you look at, for example, certain industries, like, for example, a lot of flowers are grown in Kenya in Africa and flown into Europe. So they've been really badly hit, some relatively poor Kenyan flower growers. But on the other hand, the hotels in London, they haven't got the influx of tourists that they would have expected, but they've got a whole load of tourists
who have unexpectedly had their holidays in London or their business trips in London extended, and people who probably have to go to the shops now because they've run out of clean clothes and want something smart to wear because they're actually having to work rather than spending a weekend on holiday and all
but
that
you
sort
know,
of thing.
Matthew,
these things kind of cancel each other out.
Sure. We've also heard, though, that a lot of people have been running out of money as they're stuck in these airports. Anthony Smallwood, I mean, you've got people who can't get out. They're just in those airports.
I think for many individuals, it's a very tough time.
Yeah. Oh.
And by the way, as Steve said, it's happened at a very tough time for the aircraft industry too. Although I think Matthew's right to point out that other forms of transport have done correspondingly well, that it could have been worse in the sense that it's not in the middle of the high tourist season. But I think those people who have been hit, and he mentioned, for instance, the florists and the industry in Kenya, but it's also vegetables, they've been hit very hard indeed. Kenya is dependent on these exports for 20% of its foreign exchange revenue. So there are economic impacts. It's not a disastrous economic impact, but for those it hits, whether they're individuals stuck in airports or Kenyans who feed their family on their wages in the florist industry, it's very rough.
But, you know, Matthew mentioned a little price gouging going on here, Steve. I would think that maybe that even spills over into the airline industry itself.
Well, potentially. I think right now the airlines are looking to start flights again, and the flights are limited. And I think the goal of the airlines is to accommodate as many passengers as possible, help those stranded passengers get home. And really, the airlines have added more flexibility in terms of accommodating the passengers. In fact, passengers who need to cancel the flight or have postponed flights, the airlines have waived any sort of associated fees that go along with that. And when hopefully soon flights get going again, passengers will be allowed to stand by and try to get on flights again without having any additional fees, charges to try to get them home.
There was a piece in this morning's Post about a family and an offer to get that family back to London for $9,000.
Yeah, I mean, some of these, it's really, we need to keep a close watch on that, and governments need to keep a close watch on that, because obviously that's the market. There's a small amount of seats that are out there, and we don't want to see price gouging, obviously. We're seeing it already. Get reports, as you alluded to, from other modes, other transportation industries. A colleague of mine had to pay £1,000 to rent a car yesterday per day, which is unbelievable. But I guess market forces at work, but there's a point where it does become gouging.
Well, and that is, as you suggest, the so-called free market at work taking advantage of people somehow in dire straits, which is so unfair. Matthew Bishop, as the European economy was just recovering from this global recession, how is this airline problem going to affect the economics as a whole?
Well, firstly, I mean, you're right. The European economies have been very badly hit by the same economic crisis that has crippled America over the past couple of years. And in some ways, parts of Europe have failed to recover even more than the American economy has failed to recover. Some countries like Germany have been doing quite well, but others like Greece and Spain have really been in deep, deep trouble. In the short run, if this crisis with the air travel ends in the next few days, as we all, certainly I hope will be the case, then probably the impact on the European economies as a whole will be relatively small. It's not like 9/11 occurring at a time when people were already feeling the start of a recession coming on, and it's not going to have a big psychological impact in the way that something like a terrorist attack has. It's one of those rare natural disasters that didn't kill anyone. So, you know, I think it could quickly be put in the past and return to normal. On the other hand, if this other volcano erupts, or this existing volcano continues to ground air travel, then you know, you could start to see a long-term impact on tourism, for example, which ironically will hit exactly those economies like Greece and Spain that are worst affected in Europe already, and are incredibly reliant on tourism revenues. So, you know, it's really a question of whether it's a short-term crisis or a long-term crisis.
Matthew Bishop, he's U.S. business editor, New York bureau chief for The Economist, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Peter in Tarrytown, New York, who says the airlines are complaining about the stoppage. They want compensation as a result. They're suggesting it wasn't really necessary. If they'd been allowed to fly through the ash plume and they had one of their airplanes fallen out of the sky, I wonder what they'd be saying. It seems to me that whatever action taken would have been criticized by the airline companies. Are the companies asking for compensation, Steve?
Well, some individual airlines in Europe have discussed that possibility. And as an industry, we're still working on our position, and we'll present that in Brussels later this week. It hasn't yet been decided, but there's a couple options. And in many ways, we are going back to what happened after 9/11 in the United States, where the U.S. government provided billions of dollars in relief to the airline industry. So we're looking at that as an option. We're also considering requesting of the officials in Brussels perhaps a waiver of some of the EU passenger rights and compensation rules that do require payment to some of the passengers. So I think we'll know more later in the week on what the industry will be requesting.
Here's another from Warren. He's in Arlington, Virginia. He says, I'm very concerned to hear European airlines may have been manipulating their tests to show safety, flying at unusual altitudes and in unusual paths, for example. Is someone monitoring this? Matthew Bishop, have you heard anything to this effect?
Well, I mean, I think that, as has already been mentioned, the problem with the tests that various airlines have flown in the past few days is that they don't actually know whether they were flying through the deepest parts of the ash cloud. And so it's very hard to draw any conclusions from the fact that they were undamaged by those tests, except that they managed to find some air which wasn't damaging. And that doesn't mean there isn't a lot of bad ash out there that could have wrecked the engines in the way that British Airways jet was damaged so badly 20-odd years ago, which I think is the example that we all have in mind, where the four engines on a 747 actually stopped for 15 minutes as a result of flying through volcanic ash. And I think the one thing all of us who are stranded over here in London agree is that we'd rather be frustratedly sitting on the ground than to be sitting in the air wishing we were on the ground.
I fully agree. Here's another email from Kimmo, who says, I would hope one of the repercussions of the situation might be to highlight the importance of maintaining a diversity of good transport infrastructure, especially rail. It's better for the environment, too. Anthony Smallwood, is that happening throughout Europe?
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that the spread of high-speed rail is a very welcome and a very widespread phenomenon in Europe, and I've absolutely no doubt that if I was stuck somewhere at the moment, I would bless the day that was so, if I were dashing at 300 kilometres an hour between Brussels and Paris. But I think the emailer has a good point. You cannot totally rely on one form of transport. And for instance, I mentioned the extraordinary trade in flowers and fresh vegetables, most of which are flown in to a country like Britain, something like 80% are flown in. It makes, I think, people think rather more carefully about the nature of the economies in various sectors.
Does that mean there's any shortage of particular fruits, vegetables, as well as flowers in Britain right now?
Well, thank God it didn't happen over Valentine's Day. I don't think there'd be many fresh roses around today.
But what about vegetables?
The vegetables, certainly, there's no danger in the sense that people are going to be short of food.
Yeah.
But there's going to be certainly a shortage of those rather exotic vegetables, which people assume are
readily available
all year round now.
Anthony Smallwood, he's spokesperson for the European Union delegation here in Washington, D.C. When we come back, we'll open the phones, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. From the Avis Family Foundation, supporting expanded foreign news online and on air. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
Every night, millions of viewers watch Jim Lehrer host the News Hour on PBS. Many are also fans of his novels, plays, and memoirs. He talks about his new book and journalism in the digital age. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Joining us now by phone from Somerville, Massachusetts, is Patrick Smith. He's an airline pilot. He's author of Salon's Ask the Pilot blog. Good morning to you, Patrick. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diane.
Talk about the potential risks of flying through a volcanic ash cloud.
Well, let me make this point first, Diane. The airlines, along with their advocacy groups, have become increasingly vocal over the past several days, urging that the restrictions be lifted and accusing European authorities of having mucked up the whole affair through overreaction and bureaucratic bungling. To take that second point, I'm not sure what we were supposed to expect when a natural calamity affects more than 20 sovereign nations simultaneously. I think such events really lend themselves to a certain logistical disorientation, let's just say. But meanwhile, the airlines' comments have not unpredictably brought out the cynics. With the industry losing $200 million or whatever dollars a day, it's easy to understand why they want to get flying again. But are they being reckless about it? Is there a danger here? My answer to that is probably not. I mean, there are more than enough people already out there who see airlines as the embodiment of evil on Earth, but I should remind you of the really immense liability issues at hand. Contrary to prevailing wisdom, airlines are not out there playing fast and loose with the lives of their customers. And speaking as an airline pilot, you can be rest assured that I'm not particularly eager to go out there and put myself, let alone those people on my plane, in harm's way. It just doesn't happen that way. There are some very smart, dedicated, and professional people focused on this crisis, and I think for the most part, we're doing the right thing. Things are getting slowly back to normal, and that's how we should expect it to happen. The ash cloud is not a uniform, localized thing. It's nebulous and changing literally minute to minute. The skies will reopen, but it's going to happen sector by sector, not in one big wallop.
All right. We have someone on the line. Elsa in Alachua, Florida. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
I have three sisters that we're meeting for vacation in Portugal. One is arriving in Portugal. I'm coming from the States and arriving in Britain and then flying to Portugal. And the other sister's coming from South Africa to Frankfurt and then to Portugal. My question is, I'd rather be at home and not stuck in the airport with the three of us, not being able to get to our destination. So I was trying to call the U.S. airlines, but their lines are so busy.
Sure.
I'm trying to get an answer of what should I do.
Now, let me ask you, Elsa, when are you planning to fly?
On Monday, this coming Monday.
What is your thinking, Steve Lott?
And it's a difficult situation because, you're trying to call the airlines, and that's a great first step. But unfortunately, the airlines don't have any more information than anyone else, just because it's really up to Mother Nature. And the situation really is changing hour by hour as this ash cloud moves and shifts over certain airspace. And airline networks, international networks, are such carefully orchestrated systems. It will take a long time. It will take days to get the system back to normal, and it will take days to accommodate everybody. So what we don't want to happen is, if passengers and consumers hear that flights are opening in the morning, there's no need to run to the airport to try to get on that first flight out, because the odds are very slim that you will get on that flight. So the best advice would be is just monitor not only the airline's website. You can try to keep calling the airlines, but there's other resources out there. Eurocontrol, which is a European airspace agency, has a very good website, and they've been updating their figures several times a day, and they give updates about which countries are open or closed.
How about you, Patrick? Any thoughts?
Well, let me answer your original question, Diane. You had asked me about the particular hazards of volcanic ash. Ash is a long-recognized hazard, but usually the plumes are localized and easily circumvented. What makes this one different is that it's spread horizontally over thousands of square miles and at an altitude of somewhere between 20 and 35,000 feet or so, which puts it smack in the middle of densely packed airspace, really the most densely packed airspace in the world. That's what makes this unprecedented. And the hazards of ash, ash can affect turbine engines, jet engines. It can scour windshields. It can block the sensors on a plane's exterior that feed critical information to the onboard systems. It can be very dangerous, as we saw back in the 1980s when two 747s at different points actually lost all of their engines after encounters with unforecast clouds. Now, luckily, the prognostic tools the pilots have nowadays are much more advanced than they were back then. We get volcanic ash advisories, you know, before any long-haul flight. That wasn't really true in those days.
What about a 747 or other large plane losing its engines after it flies through volcanic ash? How far, how long can it glide?
Well, an airliner has a very good glide performance, somewhere around 20 to 1, meaning for every foot it falls, it moves 20 feet forward. From 30,000 feet, give or take, you can expect to glide upwards of 100 miles. In the cases of those airplanes that lost their engines back in the 80s, the crews were able to restart the engines and managed to make safe emergency landings. And those were worst-case scenarios. Like I was saying, we have better tools and forecasting techniques at our disposal today.
So, Matthew Bishop, would you agree with the advice that Steve Lott has offered, namely simply to monitor what's happening, realizing you cannot get through on the telephone? It's almost impossible. Any other thoughts from you?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that we're all in that position sitting here in London. I mean, I've got bookings on a flight that leaves on Thursday evening, a flight that leaves on Saturday evening, and I'm just hoping that one of those, you know, I think a lot of people have done that. They've sitting here, they've booked flights on many different days. One could only imagine that when things do start to fly again, there are going to be lots of people who don't turn up for flights that they thought that people expected them to turn up on.
Sure.
So all sorts of people on standby are suddenly going to find they're able to get on a plane when they thought they weren't going to be able to get back. And likewise, I mean, Monday, where your caller was referring to, I mean, I would guess there's, it all depends really on whether the volcano stops erupting or, as we're hoping in Britain, that the wind changes direction. If the wind suddenly starts blowing north again, you know, we could see a dramatic change in the ability to fly through the London airports.
And
they're talking about maybe that will change Thursday or Friday of this week. And so even if the volcano continued in those circumstances, London would return to normal.
Yeah. And I think, Diane, also, there are two things one can say. For sure, next Monday it's going to be very different from now. It really is a moving and fairly unpredictable situation. And the second one is an obvious one, but sometimes needs to be restated. If you don't have to fly right now, now is a very good time to decide to postpone it until things calm down a bit.
All right. To Richfield, Ohio. Good morning, Logan.
Hi, Diane. My son is in has been teaching jump rope in Canberra and was planning on coming home this weekend. His flight was canceled, so he just went to Kisumu to teach some kids there. But what's surprising is his flight was to go through Heathrow and then to back to the States. And there's simply no contingency plans to bring African flyers, maybe through Dakar and straight. The network is maximized in such a way that everything doesn't have alternate plans or contingencies. And it's a poorly planned network that maximizes profit when everything works well, but creates tragedies like this when things go poorly.
Steve Lott.
Well, I think you're alluding to the what we call the hub and spoke system in airline network terms. And this ash cloud has thrown a blanket over the most important airline hubs that we have in Europe. We're looking at London, Amsterdam, Paris, Frankfurt. And, you know, some people criticize the hub and spoke system, but it's this hub and spoke system that actually allows you to fly at any point on the planet with just one stop, maybe two at most. So it actually maximizes the easiness or the it maximizes the availability of flights to passengers around the world. But you're rather than going point to point. But you're correct in that when we do close down several important hubs, it is going to ripple throughout the world. Now, some airlines are trying to reroute passengers over hubs or airports that are open. Rome is open, for example. Madrid hasn't been affected as much, and they're trying to reroute passengers as much as possible. But when we do throw, it's like closing down Grand Central Station in New York. That's where all the trains come into and out of.
What about Paris?
Paris, it's been a bit mixed. The past few days it has been closed, but even within France, we've seen southern France has been open. Nice, Toulouse, Marseille have been open, but Paris is obviously the large, powerful hub where you can get to any point in the world, and it's been closed more than it's been open.
All right. Dan, to Jason in Arlington, Virginia. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, my question had to do with the airline industry is asking for help from the government. Isn't this wouldn't this be an instance where having an insurance policy to cover these things would be something that'd be helpful to, or would be expected? And I guess I can just take that answer off the air.
Sure, Steve.
Sure, and it's a good question, and it's one that we've been getting a lot because the insurance policies in the airlines do have a lot of insurance policies to protect against damage for their aircraft and other things. But really, this falls under the category of force majeure, as we say, which is an act of God. It's Mother Nature. And the same goes for a hurricane or a big blizzard like we saw here on the East Coast this past winter. And there's really, unfortunately, no protection against these types of incidents, these types of Mother Nature crippling the industry. So really, the insurance companies don't protect against these sorts of acts.
Diane, could I add something?
Certainly. Go right ahead.
In reference to the previous caller's point, an airline can't simply arbitrarily decide which cities they want to fly into on a given day because Heathrow is blocked. You can't decide, well, we'll just funnel everybody through Dakar. There are certification issues, rights issues. Airlines have to be really certified to fly to a given city. They can't just pick cities on a map and decide they're going to reroute all of their logistics through that point because of a crisis somewhere else. It's much more complicated than that.
Patrick Smith, he's an airline pilot, author of Salon's Ask the Pilot blog. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Donnell in Florida. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm a recently discovered your show, and I love it.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
Okay. If this volcanic eruption had occurred and disrupted American air traffic in our country, the flying public would be out of luck. I heard a fleeting reference this morning on your show to a European system of compensation for delayed air travel. How does this work, and can you give me a reference where I can see it on the web? And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for calling. Steve.
Sure, and it's a complicated subject and probably a subject for a whole nother show. But it's been in place in the EU, and perhaps Anthony can address it as well, but it's been in place for a number of years now. And we have shared our concerns and criticisms of these compensation rules in the EU because really our concerns are airlines in many cases are forced to compensate passengers for things that are out of their control, including weather delays and other such delays. And it has been a contentious issue. It actually went to the European Court of Justice within the past 6 months for interpretation. The rules were very vague. And it is a big point of contention between industry and Brussels.
Anthony.
Yeah. I don't know the details on this one, but I am aware of them, and I am aware that they are broadly extremely popular with consumers. Now, no doubt the airline industry would say, well, of course they are. But I would say, of course, they should be. They are measures to protect the traveling public. Quite clearly, when you have events like this, which throw unusual, untypical, and abnormal stress and strain on the system, it's often time to look at them again.
Okay, but you all are talking vaguely. What kind of compensation may be due those individuals who are stranded right now, who may have to seek lodging, who are stranded for days without money? What kind of compensation can they get? Matthew Bishop, can you respond?
I'm afraid not in a great deal of detail on that one. I know that certainly it's not going to help people with the majority of their living costs if they're stuck in a place for a long period of time.
Okay, Anthony.
And sort of basic costs.
On detail, I better not try because I'd probably get it wrong on that one. My IATA colleague may know more.
Well, and again, I think this is going to be a point of contention in the coming days because there have been European politicians that have said the rules still apply and airlines should compensate passengers for these lengthy delays. The airlines say, no, this is an unusual circumstance. So I think this is going to continue over the course of the next few days.
Do you think this is going to have to be mediated or taken to court, or what is your thinking?
It will be. In fact, since these rules went into effect, there's been numerous lawsuits in Europe over these rules. And again, I think it is going to require some sort of mediation or a judge to make a decision.
So it could be quite a while before we know whether those people who've been stranded are going to be compensated at all. Anthony.
My understanding is, though the rules are contentious, the position of the European Union and of the individual governments is that as of today, they apply.
Anthony Smallwood. He's spokesman for the European Union delegation in Washington. Steve Lott, he's head of communications for the International Air Transport Association in North America. Matthew Bishop, he's with The Economist. Patrick Smith, he's an airline pilot, author of Salon's Ask the Pilot blog. I'm Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.